I've met some of you and have had some wonderful conversations with some of you. You know, I think the tragedy of a place like Holden is that there are just so many people and such beautiful people that one would like to get to know very intimately. And there just isn't the chance to do that. But those of you I've met, it's been really neat to be here with you. My name is Sammy Mayer, and I noticed that my bio somehow was lost on the board with someone who was taken down from last week. So I want to say a little bit about myself. My topic today, under an overall topic of when we say yes to service, we say yes to love. We want to talk about that today in some very theological terms. I think I always feel I know what that means, but I think we can unpack some really neat stuff for ourselves, and I, depending on you, for some good conversation about that. My real name is Selma. And in high school, I lived with a woman who was, I lived at the professor's homes at Concordia Teachers College. And they didn't have room in the dorms yet for the women. And so I was a freshman in high school. I was at boarding school and lived with a college woman who was very silly. She was very facetious and said all kinds of silly things. And she didn't like my name. And so she started to call me Salmon, the fish. And from that word came Sammy, and it has never left me. And so that's how these crazy things happen. But I had always wanted a nickname when I was a kid, and so I finally have one. Anyway, I have, in my lifetime, I probably had three lifetimes, as my husband often said. We spent 17 years in India as missionaries. That was my topic for last week, the cross-cultural experiences of India related to the U.S. The last 9 years, I have served as the national coordinator for AELC Women in a movement for change. And in that capacity, I've had the wonderful privilege of working with LCA and ALC Women in planning the new women's organization and the new commission. And I happen to be now a board member for the Commission for Women. And I decided after December 31st that I would back off of everything for a while. I think it's sort of what keeps a person going. You know, when you make those long-term goals, I have been burned out, I feel I have given my best, and it's time now to go into silence and really to take rest. And I have done that with a clear conscience. It's been marvelous, with a totally clear conscience. And I have 8 children and 8 grandchildren, and my kids have been, I had 5 weddings in the last 2 years, and all of them are having little ones now. So I'm having a ball just going from California to New York to New Orleans, and 5 of them live very close to me in St. Louis, and for which I'm very grateful, because my husband died 4 years ago. So that's about me. I want to say something about the rest of the week. The other topics that I want to zero in on are the other implications of service. Today it's love. Tomorrow it will be we say yes to grace. And even though that's linked very closely with love, I really had trouble with that one, but I didn't want to pitch it because it's really an important dynamic in the whole ministry of service that so many of us are engaged in. And then on the next day, we say yes to justice. When we do service, we say yes to justice. And on the final day, I'm going to be dealing with we say yes to hope and life. I had originally divided that into 2 sessions, but we have so many wonderful staff here this year that each of us got a little bit of a freedom, and we only have 4 for each of us to deal with. As I say, even though every one of these is interwoven and really feeds upon the other, I think that it's very helpful, and it's been helpful for me, to unpack each one of these various issues that are related to service. Last week in one of my sessions that was called, really I called it a dance in the valley of dry bones, it really meant an infection of life in a world of dying, I talked about the church and we as the church in mission. That when we talk about ourselves in that way, that our only agenda, and I say that very advisedly, our only agenda is people. Now, we can have all kinds of programs and property meetings and a tally of how many members have joined this year, but our agenda is people. The word mission means to send. It's a verb. It's a journey word. You never arrive with the word mission. You are always on a journey. And that is why we people, the church in mission, are there for people, to touch them, to lift them, to restore them, to help renew them toward wholeness for themselves, in relationship to their God, in relationship to their world and their environment. So I talked about that, and I think it's important to kind of keep that in mind as we think about service, because service is an outflowing activity. You empty yourself in service. And we do that today with love. That's what we're going to talk about. So what is service? How do we understand that? I think that obviously we could go all over the map with that thing, you know, all the service things we have today in the hospitals and for the aged, but we're talking about us as Christians and biblically based today. Jesus teaches us some very clear basics about service. In the book of Matthew, and we're all so familiar with that passage, he says, "I was thirsty, I was hungry, I was naked, I was in prison, and I was sick. And you gave me what I needed. You gave me food, you gave me clothes, you cared for me, you visited me in prison." And I think that those categories that Jesus raises up for us could be just, we could go on and on about what we are called to. What are those areas of service that we are called to? And I think it would be good to throw out a few that would match what Jesus is really saying. I was old. I was disabled. I was an orphan. I was without a ride to church. I was illiterate. I was unemployed, and I was abused, and I was raped. I was lonely. I was without civil rights. I was without a home. I was without a place to sleep. I was abandoned, and I was without somebody to pray for me. We could just go on and on to infinity, in which God is calling us and defining for us our ministry of service to all of God's people and all of God's creation. It's really too much to bear to realize how much need there is and how much love it takes. The energy, the capacity to love is beyond our human ability. And I think the other thing for us to keep in mind is that God is really interested in our caring for one another and how we can help one another. Remember that in the beginning, God searched for Cain and said, "Cain, where is your brother Abel?" And I don't think that that just had to do with an inquiry into murder. I think that had to do with caretaking. "Cain, you have not loved yourself enough and have not loved your brother." There's also a very beautiful and challenging picture of humanity linked in a relationship in the womb of God. It's a favorite of mine because it's so seldom that one evokes feminist images of God. It was so helpful for me to read this. It is in the New Testament, and I know that you have heard it since you've been a child. It's in the book of Acts, the 17th chapter. "God is not far from any one of us, since it is in God that we live and that we move and that we have our being. If there is anything closer to a fetus coming to birth, I don't know what it is. That is us. We are in a God-created brotherhood and sisterhood. There are no exemptions to those who are to be served. No exemptions.
Acts 17:14.
I don't know the verse.
Oh,
I just
I'm
put
sorry.
Down. I can look it up for you afterwards. You got a Bible there. Okay, we'll look it up. So we are together, the entire world creation, in a God-created, not just a happenstance brotherhood and sisterhood, but in a God-created brotherhood and sisterhood. And in Romans, there is a very clear passage, treat everyone with equal kindness. Never be condescending, but make real friends with the poor. If your enemy is hungry, give her food, and if thirsty, let him drink. That's beautiful. And in John, 1 John, if anyone who is rich enough in this world's goods and sees that one of his or her brothers or sisters was in need, but closed her heart to him, how could the love of God be living in her or him? We know and believe that God is calling us to serve one another in love, with grace, for justice, to give hope and life. God is wonderful. God is beautiful. If you look at these, some of these passages, it's just absolutely incredible. Do any other passages of love, you know, they are just, oh, the Bible is just rich with these passages that call us to love. Yeah, do any pop into your mind besides those that I have just read?
For God to love the world.
Oh, yeah. There we see God's love reaching out to the entire world. That's a good one. Another one about anything about us together in love.
Being kind, Ephesians 4, I think. Being kind one to another.
And loving one another, yes. I'm not sure of that one either.
Tenderhearted, loving one
yes,
another.
Yes, caring for one another. That's true. That's right.
Song of Solomon, this is my beloved, this is my friend.
Oh, yes. That's
love
lovely from the Old
I
Testament.
Love you.
Pardon?
Love one another as I have loved you.
Love one another as I have loved you. There's some more.
The word forgetting is in that same one that I...
Yes, yes. I think we read it last week in one of the rainbow presentations. That's a beautiful one. Anybody else? Love is what? What does Christ say? Love is...
The fulfilling of the law.
It's the fulfilling of the law. Actually, love. By love. We fulfill the law. And in the in the prayer of Jesus before he goes to the cross, love one another as I have loved you. That whole John passage is just about love. And in fact, I think one of our songs have been based on that. They will know we are Christians by our love. So very beautiful.
Tammy, 1 John 3:17-18, which concludes, my children, our love should not be just words and talk. It must be true love, which shows itself in action.
Oh, that's gorgeous. Oh, that's wonderful. That I missed that.
And
one.
That Acts passage is 17:28.
17:28, thank you.
In God we live and move and have our being.
Thanks, John.
There's another verse that, I'm not quoting it word-for-word,
Yes. Thank you for that. I based one of my sessions last week on the book Dark. I get confused because I said once, you know, being Rainbow Week, we should really say darken our lightness instead of lighten our darkness. But anyway, the book is called Lighten Our Darkness. Really a heavy, heavy book, but just a wonderful book. And he made the point that that the opposite of sin is not righteousness, but it is love. He said, because sin is our darkness in our loneliness, and in our broken relationships, in our sickness, it causes all the divisions and brokenness. Righteousness can never bring healing, only love. And I thought that was a profound insight It was very a new concept to me that we don't usually think of the opposite of sin as love, which heals that brokenness that we face in the world. Wherein lies our power to love? You know, I think that we feel the Holy Spirit grants us that power, but I found a wonderful, some marvelous imagery and a very theological statement that has helped me a great deal to kind of rethink who we are as the body of Christ. How many of you have ever heard of Elizabeth Bettenhausen? Anybody know Elizabeth? Okay, she's a very unusual speaker. And when our AELC women's group was sort of getting on its feet, we kind of had a new birthing with our new church, the women had a couple of national convocations, and Elizabeth was there for our first one and was also there for one of our very later ones. In her address, she called up a lot of Luther's theology. And that kind of surprised me about Elizabeth. She's a real Luther scholar, but she usually kind of hangs in her with the feminist scholars. But she really called up Luther's theologizing in his sermons, I learned some things that I have never connected with the sacraments before. When we talk about the sacraments that we, especially as Lutherans, hold up, are baptism and the Eucharist. And in terms of the sacrament of baptism, I believe certainly that we were made God's child. That's what I believe to be true. But Luther, she said, carried that much farther. He called baptism a flood of grace, comparing it to Noah's flood of wrath. This flood of grace, Luther said, pours over hundreds of thousands of people over years and years, and in it, God allies himself, herself with us, with you, and becomes one with you in a gracious covenant of comfort. God becoming flesh, becoming one with us. In his sermon on the Eucharist, he goes much, much farther, she said. He says that the effect of the Eucharist is the fellowship of the saints. It is the feast of love. The immediate purpose is that we all get baked into one loaf of bread, that we become one another, and that we are bound together in a service of love to one another in that one loaf. Elizabeth did a really funny thing there. She just said, now this might just blow your minds, folks, you know how she talks. And she divided the whole group, and she said, now just imagine that you're flour, and you're the yeast, and you're the milk, and you're the water or sugar. And she said, just imagine just putting that all into a bowl and mixing it and stomping it, letting it rise, punching it down, letting it rise, punching it down, and letting it rise. She really went into this, you know. And she said, and by the time that thing is baked and pulled out of the oven, one slice may be the tip of your little finger. And she said that we become one loaf. I'm going to ask you to bear with me while I read just a couple of quotes. I simply could not put these in my own words, and they have meant so much to me in terms of my understanding of us here at Holden, though we come from many denominations, and how our love infects one another, how we do service to one another. Oh, there's a lot to talk about. That Holden community is out of sight when you think about that service that is done to us. Never with wrath or anger or just complaining, with complete love. It's just overwhelming for me. This is what she says. Some of these are her quotes and others are Luther's. Luther develops the metaphor this way. Once you have been baptized into the Christ, and once you participate in Holy Communion, you can no more be a separate individual than can the flour which has been baked into the loaf of bread and eaten. The same is true with the wine. Once you have stomped the grapes, put it into the bottle, waited 20 years for it to ferment, open the cork and drink the wine. You cannot separate out one grape anymore. That is his metaphor for Christians in the body of Christ. This view of the sacraments has ethical consequences for Luther. He says, and I quote, "For the sacrament has no blessing and significance unless love grows daily and so changes a person that he or she is made one with all others. To receive the Eucharist is to take on the condition of others in the community, and indeed outside the community, take on the condition of. In this way, we are changed into one another and are made into a community of love. Without love, there can be no such change. This is the opposite of being turned in upon oneself in an isolated way. The forgiveness of that sin, meaning being turned in on yourself, not only it forgives it in the Eucharist, but begins the process of change in which the individual is no longer individual, but becomes precisely part of this new creation, which is the body of Christ." And one more where he makes this very, very clear. Here, this is Luther's quote from a sermon. "Here your heart must go out in love and learn that this is a sacrament of love. As love and support are given you, you must in turn render love and support to Christ in his needy ones. You must feel with sorrow all the dishonor done to Christ in his holy word, all the misery of Christendom, all the unjust suffering of the innocent with which the world is everywhere filled to overflowing. You must fight, work, pray, and if you can't do any more, then have sympathy." I think that's wonderful, you know, how Luther talked about that. I just thought this was just very urgent for us to hear those words. Because we are, you know, it goes completely against the individualism which is raised up so much in our capitalistic society. Just incredibly community building, and that we lean on one another, we depend on one another. We cannot survive as individual islands all the time. We can for a time, but we need one another. Okay. As I was saying before, I personally, and I think you too, are sometimes just overwhelmed by the capacity on the part of people to love. To love so completely, you know, with open hearts, and when a need is there, there's never a question as to how great the need or can I do it. They just plunge right in. I'm sure you could name many, many women and men who are in this kind of ministry with one another. And I think we church people, we run our legs off in service. You know, I think it's particularly true of us women. And I don't intend to negate anything that men do, but I think it is true. Our middle name could be service. Our nurturing of children, our preparing of the meals, our doing the laundry, being ready to take care of the pets and the programs and all the people around the neighborhood. We literally do. We run our legs off comforting and cleaning and doing all kinds of duties of service that seem almost endless. My mother was a person like that. She just seemed to be on a marathon of service. And I remember early in my married life, and remember, this was 40 years ago. I hope things have changed since then. But she said something that I have never forgotten, and I'm still trying to sort it out. I don't know how many of you understand German, but she said to me, die Mutter ist das Fenster um Ganzes. That means the mother is the fence around everything. And you know, I think that that's the way we as mothers have been super moms, haven't we? We have simply broadened ourselves and stretched ourselves until we cannot anymore, and we have become the fence around everything. And I think it's still true today. You know, there are some changes, but it's usually mom. When there is a couple, let's put it that way, mom who sets the tone in the family, who picks up the pieces of chaos and tries to bring wholeness back into that family again. And she is always there after school, unless she's a working mother and has some care for her children. And I think that my mother, you know, and it wasn't only in the family. We had a woman who had a nervous breakdown about five blocks away. She was a very ugly woman, and I never could understand my mother's love for her. But we had to, as little kids, carry soup, five blocks on a plate, all covered, and Sunday dinners of ham and mashed potatoes to Miss Bohnstengel. I hated her name, too. I was terrified to go into this house because she had been a teacher, and she had real thick glasses, and she was a frightening woman, and my mother, without fail, would take that, and we kids would have to do that and carry butter there. Things like that. And she did this with a cancer patient across the way who had no faith in the Christ. But she would just sit with her, and this woman was in just agony and pain and no money to go to the hospital. And she would just hold her hand and say, just say, Jesus, come, Jesus, come. You know, and my mother did that. She would sit with her for hours and do that. And it was a kind of love that I never forgot. But, you know, she did this at the expense of herself. I don't think she had the energy to take care of herself anymore. And I'm not sure if that was right. You know, I've got a big question about that. How much do we love? How much do we give out? Because that's what God calls us to. You know, no self-giving love. And only we can know when that moment has come where we say, now I need to love myself. Otherwise, I cannot even love other people. And I think we all come to that point.
Sammy.
Yes. Randy.
But don't you think back, I don't know, I'm just guessing, 40 years ago when your mom was doing that?
Yeah.
The concept of loving ourselves wasn't popularized back then.
Oh, you're right.
And
definitely.
Now I don't know, I'm just thinking that's starting to change somewhat. But back then, it was taught that you don't.
That was even a sin, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that was a sin that, did you talk about that, or Joanna or Mary, you know, that we dare not love ourselves. Mm-hmm. Not even as not single persons, like Joanna was talking about last night, but even as a woman of a couple, you know, because we are womanhood. You know, we had learned to really divest ourselves of the very energy that it took to love ourselves and to take the time for that.
Well,
I want to.
It's a biblical word. That
yes.
We love our neighbor as we love ourselves.
As we love
not
ourselves.
Not instead of.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. That's true.
Could I add?
Yes.
Here?
Yes.
What you said about carrying soup to the neighbors.
Yeah.
That reminds me so much of my maternal grandmother. Every Saturday in our little town, she would make Apfelkuchen, and she always hoped that there would be a grandchild come to town, so to tote these Apfelkuchens to her friends, who elderly friends who didn't have much to live on. She had more of this worldly goods than some of those people, and I related to what you said.
I know, and I bet you people could, we could have hundreds of stories right here of that kind of loving, you know, of always being concerned, and I think especially women, we're always concerned that nobody gets stomped on. You know, we don't want anybody to get stomped on, and I think we do. We give ourselves to that, and that's a beautiful gift that God has given to us, too, that we have that nurturing. And I know that there are many men who have that as well. But I think it is good to raise that up because I feel sometimes that women do not care for themselves in love enough, that they do care so much for other people. We want to talk a lot I want to leave at least 15, 20 minutes where we can share our stories and what maybe that has even done to us. But I ran across something else that I want to share with you. In terms of, I think that all of us, maybe not to the extent as someone else, but I think we've all at some point come to the point where we don't know anymore what it means, or we don't know how to deal with those times when we feel swallowed up by people. You know, we just feel completely drowning and not able to catch our breath because of the demands on our lives by people. And I think that we need to look at that very carefully and with some good Christian theology too. But you know, when I was, I brought something along that is just a wonderful poem. It's just a little bit long. It's a prayer, actually. And when I was younger and we had just come from India, I had the 8 kids, and I just was, it was a time in my life when I was just overwhelmed with work and where the duties of the household were just so intense. And in my husband Jim's office, I found a prayer book by Michel Quast. And he has these marvelous people prayers. You know, service is a people thing. And he had one prayer that I just glopped onto. It was so just heartrending for me. It gave me courage, but I'd like to know your feeling about this prayer after I read it. He says, Lord, why did you tell me? In fact, the whole prayer is called, Lord, why did you tell me to love? Lord, why did you tell me to love everyone, my brothers and sisters? I have tried, but I come back to you frightened. Lord, I was so peaceful at home. I was so comfortably settled. It was well furnished, and I felt cozy. I was alone, and I was at peace, sheltered from the wind, the rain, the mud. I would have stayed unsullied in my ivory tower, but Lord, you have discovered a breach in my defenses. You have forced me to open my door. Like a squall of rain in the face, the cry of humanity has awakened me. Like a gale of wind, a friendship has shaken me. As a ray of light slips unnoticed, your grace has stirred me, and rashly enough, I left my door ajar. Now, Lord, I'm lost. Outside, people were lying in wait for me. I did not know they were so near, in this house, in this street, in this office. My neighbor, my colleague, my friend. As soon as I started to open the door, I saw them. And with outstretched hands, burning eyes, longing hearts, like beggars on church steps. The first ones came in, Lord. There was, after all, some space in my heart. I welcomed them. I would have cared for them and fondled them, my very own little lambs, my little flock. You would have been pleased, Lord. I would have served them and honored you in a proper, respectable way. Until then, it was sensible. But the next ones, Lord, the other folks, I had not seen them. They were hidden behind the first ones. There were more of them. They were wretched. They overpowered me without warning. We had to crowd in. I had to find room for them. And now they have come from all over, in successive waves, pushing one another, jostling one another. They have come from all over town, from all parts of the country, of the world, numberless, inexhaustible. They don't come alone any longer, but in groups, bound one to another. They come bending under heavy loads, loads of injustice, of resentment and hate, of suffering and sin. They drag the world behind them with everything rusted, twisted, or badly adjusted. Lord, they hurt me. They are in the way and they're everywhere. They're too hungry. They're consuming me. I can't do anything anymore. As they come in, they push the door and the door opens wider. Lord, my door is wide open and I can't stand it anymore. It's too much. It's no kind of a life. What about my job, my family, my peace, my liberty, and me? I have lost everything, Lord. I don't belong to myself any longer. There's no more room for me at home. Don't worry, God says. You have gained all. While all those came into you, I, your father, your parent, I, your God, slipped in among them. And you know, for some reason, that gave me courage. That gave me courage to move on, because all those slipping in our doors are little Christs. It is the God who comes in among them. And I think of the story of Jesus and the healing of Peter's mother-in-law. When he, after he healed her, he went out into the crowd, and the crowd had already gathered. It was dark outside. They were faceless people. And he went out into the crowd, and the disciples as well, and made faceless, face-filled forms, gave these people personalities, gave them a name, and made out of faceless people a community. And that is the picture that I get when I read Michelle Quast. And I think that those are the impacts that crowd in on us when we hear about South Africa, and we hear about Central America, and we hear about the homeless and the hungry and the injustices in the world, and we just say, stop it! I just can't take it anymore because I don't know where to start. And that's another whole topic. Mm-hmm. But I feel that God is preparing us for that moment of opportunity where we step into those moments without even a realization that they will be an opportunity for service. And when they come, may God give us the grace and the courage to take hold of that dawn, of that moment of opportunity, and not to let it slip by so that dawn turns into dusk and we have left someone bereft and alone. And I think it is something for us to talk about. But let's talk about that. What do you feel about that prayer? You know, it disturbed me in a way. What in the world am I being called to? You know, and it's an overwhelming prayer. Or let's hear some of your stories of incredible love that you have been able to share with family, or
a story of incredible hopelessness. One of our daughters spent was a volunteer corps year in Baltimore, and working with women in the city prison and also primarily at the Jessup facility in Maryland Corrections, the women's prison. And found herself, it sounds commendable and all that sort of thing, working with pre-release women prisoners, primarily getting them ready to hit the streets, go back into society. And for her, it was a terribly hopeless, defeating year. Women who had at least 15 strikes against them from before they ever got to prison in the first place. Virtually all of them black, virtually all of them abused, and just virtually all of them without any ray of hope, whatever. And it was just a year of sort of slogging it through and you know, thinking many times of quitting. But just about turned her from social work entirely, which was her graduate, her major in college. But it was really a year of dealing with hopelessness and not being able to really ever get out of that. And that happens. You know, there are situations where that's, you need some kind of hope or reorientation or some kind of vision.
And a support community. You know, I think that people in that kind of social work, they face out to the world. I did a little exercise in one of our classes last week of how we see the church, you know, and 10 of us held hands and faced into the church, and that is a time that we need together. But that is not the normal mission of the church, not the normal stance of a church in mission. The normal stance is for us to be facing out to the world and still holding hands together so that we have the support and the wherewithal to do this. I always think that people in social ministry have got to have a special sense besides the five that we have to really do all of this with love among so many unlovable people. It is truly it's something, it's people that we need to pray for a lot, that they have that they maintain the love. You know, that it makes a difference. You go into a hospital and you get served by someone who does not love you as a patient. And how the healing process is slowed down by that. Did you know that? That the love that people share with one another in the healing process is something which lends itself, it's like a medicine. And they've actually done studies on this where people have been loved and cared for rather than just perfunctorily given medications, heal twice as fast as other people do. And we know that among our children. You know, they heal from hurts and from abuse of words, you know, when they are loved so completely. Anybody else want to share a story? Randy?
Yeah, I used to work with emotionally disturbed adolescents in a hospital setting. I did that for a while, and it got real frustrating just seeing the kids go through, go out, come back in, go through, go out. But what made it all worthwhile, after I got out of it, about 6 months later, young gal came up to me and said, "You remember me?" And I looked at her and said, "Yeah, you're one of the kids I worked with, right?" She said, "Yeah, I'm in college now, I'm married." She said, "I have two kids, got a job, and I'm doing great." And
those are some of the payoffs, aren't they?
That made it all worthwhile.
Yes,
gee, you know, it's miserable a lot of the time, but when you do hear the successes, it's like,
Really? And they are there, you know, they are there for the strokes that we need sometimes. I have just a brief little funny story that happened to me, and I still can't believe it happened. It was one of the coldest winters in St. Louis. It was 7 below. It never gets that cold. The pipes were freezing, and my old Buick, my husband had died already, and I was very angry at him because he wasn't there, you know, to help with these cars and all this, and he was always under the hood anyway. And he really was. He would get home from a meeting and he'd be under the car. He loved cars. And so I never had to worry about that old 73 Buick. And so my daughter came home from New York, and she had to leave on a real early plane. And so I said, "Well, the Buick is fine." And so we had to leave like at 5 a.m. and it was still dark out, you know. And there we got onto the highway. It was about 3 miles from our house, and we turned the curve, you know, and of course the car just completely conked out. It was dark, and to walk that distance of 2 or 3 miles, we would have gotten a face burn and who knows what, and frostbite. And I tell you, we just sat there, and both of us just about bawled. We just simply did not know what to do. And cars were whizzing by us, even at that hour in the morning. And a couple cars down the road, we could see their lights flashing, and I thought, well, somebody else is in trouble. So we put on our flashers, and, you know, we just literally sat there, I think, for 10 minutes, not knowing what to do. And you're kind of scared anyway, because you hear of these men coming and taking women in their cars and raping them, and all, I mean, all these images go through your head. And all of a sudden, a car pulled up right behind us, and I thought, oh no, here we go. And this man got out, a little short man, and he said, "Are you folks in trouble?" And I thought, oh, likely question. You know, I was, I mean, it's just horrible how you're just suspicious. You can't even accept any kind of kindness at a time like that. I said, oh, likely question. And so I kind of looked at him out of the corner of my eyes, and I said, "Well, we sure are in trouble." I said, "Our car is just completely conked out." He said, "Well, let me have a look." So he picked up the hood, and he said, "Oh, you've got a broken radiator hose and the whole thing." He said, "You're not going to get home." And I said, "Oh, that's great." And so he said, "Why don't you two folks go back in my car and just sit there? I've got blankets in there. I have thermoses." And I thought, oh, my goodness, I don't think I can do this. And, you know, still that complete suspicion. And so my daughter and I, we said, well, at least we have each other. So we got in the car. Sure enough, there were blankets and a thermos. And he said, let me just, that was before he found the hose. You know, he was still looking around there. And he came back. He said, "Well, you're just not going anywhere." And so he said, "Where do you live?" And I said, "We live about 3 miles from here." And then he said, "Well, I'll drive you home." I mean, this man came out of nowhere at 5 o'clock in the morning. And he got in the car, and I directed him home. And while he was in the car, he told his story, that he belonged to a Church of the Covenant way up in North St. Louis. I mean, that was like 30, 40 miles away. And he, all night long, was going around in his car looking for people in trouble. That was his ministry. And that dear gentleman should come to our car at 5 a.m. Well, I was so flabbergasted. I said, I didn't get his phone number. I didn't get his name. I didn't get anything. He dropped us off, and he said, "I'll have to call my wife and just let her know where I am." You know, I'm still in shock about that kind of loving service of this man. And I really, to this day, I don't know who he was, and I feel very ashamed about that. I should have put a notice in the paper and said, whoever picked us up on Highway 270. But those are the things that happen to us, you know, that are just unbelievable. Anything else? Kind of horned my way in there. Yes, Ruth.
Well, I think especially of a time in my life when we were at Trinity First in Minneapolis, which is just about the most inner city church except Central. And it was at a time when the neighborhood was rapidly, as they said, going to the dog. There were very few normal families anymore. And so many, many young Indians coming from the reservations and living there. In other words, unbelievable amounts of really social problems. And we knew very well what all had to be done, but of course we did not have the staff, we did not have the money. And it was a time, as you said first, of things just crowding in on us. Mm-hmm. Duke and I would pray, oh Lord, just send us one person to be a parish worker. Well, anyway, it was such a time. At first, we almost felt snowed under. And then the Lord let us understand that we do whatever He gave us the strength and the resources to do and continue really, really praying. It was quite a time. There's so many things that I could talk about, especially probably among the American Indians. But then now, praise God, that congregation has accepted a real inner city type program. In fact, they have a called American Indian on the, you know, we've been long gone. But I think that we planted the seeds for this type of thing.
Really? And,
oh, what an ever-present help the Lord is. But indeed, there are times when you just think, Lord, not one more. And then we live right downtown, too. My husband felt very strongly we should live in the area to which we were ministering. So we had so many people come to our doors. And at last, the word gets out in the community. Hey, he's a soft touch, you know.
Certainly.
So we had a real succession of people coming to our doors, including the young man on Saturday night with his pockets or his jeans full of slot machine winnings, and he came in on our kitchen table and dumped all his, he hit the jackpot, and he wanted to get married. How much does it cost? And he had a little James gal in tow, and
that's great.
Well, it doesn't cost anything, but, well, I figured I wanted to give something. Is that enough? Well, anyway.
I think, yes.
Now looking back, those were really great years.
Yes, truly, and you know, that's the other part of this, and I wasn't sure how to fit this in, but that, you know, that loving is it's a real skill, and we're going to probably talk about that aspect of grace.
It's a real skill, especially when they smell very unwashed, and well, their noses are running. And,
yes, that's true, yeah. But that we as helpers maintain also and really are conscious of the dignity of the people to whom we are serving. Those people whom we are serving, we need to kind of rid ourselves of the picture of helper, helpee. That this is a moment in our lives where God has also granted us a learning from another people. It's a reciprocal sort of thing. And when we say we're doing service, it's always a danger that, you know, that we need to give of ourselves and that we are really just helping these people until they get back to wholeness. And that's partially true, but it is a reciprocal thing in that we maintain the dignity of people whom we're serving and that we are learners in the process as well.
You bet. Sam,
yes. Yes.
I'd like to add another dimension to
yeah.
that.
Joy.
I think I've found that Christians have a great deal of trouble receiving well.
Receiving.
And I think that there is always that idea that you also have to be a servant.
Yeah.
And a very wise friend in my life taught me long ago that to receive well is to give a gift in return. And I think we need to keep that in the forefront too.
Yes. That's very... That really is, it should have been a whole kernel of our talk here today. And I hope we're going to get to that in some of the other talks of, you know, how do you do justice? And what does it mean to serve with grace? You know, with that whole aspect of grace to the, you know, the undeserving. That's a whole, it's a whole part. Yeah.
We're talking about compassion fatigue, I think.
Yeah.
I remember some, two instances that are kind of humorous, I guess. One is kind of humorous, but it also illustrates how in the church we are subject to compassion fatigue. Some years ago, I was working with our denomination's hunger program, and one day we got a call from somebody in the congregation saying, we're planning our coming year's social ministry emphasis, and we wonder what the chief issue is for the coming year. And then she said, we've already done hunger. I knew what she was saying. We've completed that. That was our emphasis this past year, and now we want to move on to something else. And in that moment, you kind of want to giggle, or you want to say, hey, hunger will be with us forever. That wasn't what was needed. But what was being said was, we get weary of dealing with one cause, and we want to move on to another. The other thing I recall is talking with people at LSS of Minnesota about how in the mid-70s, a lot of our congregations in Minnesota responded to the need for refugee resettlement. Mm-hmm. And they did it, and it was primarily Southeast Asians at that time. Mm-hmm. And then they got weary of that after several years, and some continued, but others dropped out. And as we moved into the 80s and there were new waves of refugees coming, still some from there, but also from Ethiopia and other parts of the world, many congregations were saying, hey, wait a minute, we've already done that. We're tired of that. We want to do something else now. And of course, there are always other needs, but some needs continue forever. My sense is that we will always be responding to hunger for the rest of our lives, and we'll always be responding to refugees and the needs of refugees. That will never end. And Maybe congregations have to get a new wave of send in another team,
yes,
or something like that, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, give those who've been working through the first two quarters a rest. I think that's appropriate. But for the church as a whole, there's no way we're going to run out of hunger or run out of refugee resettlement. And when you read the Quas poem, that's what I thought of, these waves of refugees that keep coming, just never ending.
Never ending.
And probably more every year than the year before. And if we expect that someday that problem will be resolved, we're, I think, misleading ourselves.
Yes.
And yet we have to find ways of dealing with the very understandable compassion fatigue that sets in after a while.
Very,
and not expect the same ones among us to do it year after year after year.
That's right.
There's a division of labor that we somehow have to come to.
Sure.
And I guess the other thing is, and maybe you'll get to this later in the week, yeah, we are fairly good in the church at dealing with the victims of the casualties.
Society, the casualties, yeah.
We aren't so good at dealing with the causes of those casualties.
That's right.
We haven't figured out yet how to work effectively to end the flow of refugees.
That's
right. We drag people out of that river, or about to drown.
They keep throwing them in.
But
back there,
somebody upstream is throwing them in, and we got to get at that. And that's much more difficult because that's much more political.
It's much more political. That's right. And that's what the last 2 weeks have been, those political roots that we have to get at in order to also shift and to bring healing to the process and to how we see other human beings and people. That's
sure.
Very realistic.
I'm not sure we're so good with the victims of a whole lot of things.
Okay.
And particularly if they don't sort of fit. I work some in the Walker Clinic, which is a clinic for AIDS victims.
Oh, yeah.
And their families. And our churches are not very interested in Washington, D.C., in the Walker Clinic. It's like they have the plague, and the plague is their fault, regardless of the onslaught. And they're not even willing to contribute funds. I think funds, it's a heck of a lot easier for me to give money than to do anything. And when they're not even ready to go that distance, I'm not sure that our churches really want to be concerned with anything except what they want to be concerned with.
Now, some victims are more acceptable than others.
Well, and these are definitely not acceptable victims.
That's right. Thanks for that insight, Joanne.
I have to agree with
Joanne.
I
really.
in our work with foster children. There's a distant kind of reception in the eye of those who, oh, that our people in church say, oh, it's a wonderful thing that you're doing. But, and I never really quite know how to respond to that, because we are doing it as a ministry. We certainly don't, you know, do it for the money, which is a lot of people's perception. But we do not know how to minister to families in trouble in our congregation. We do not know how to do that. I don't know how to help our people do that, but I agree with you. I think that we are not very good at offering victims in that circumstance the kind of service that is really needed, and I mean in the families of our nation.
Yes.
We do not know how to reach at the root causes of that, which as far as we're concerned, it's alarming. It's a lot like the poem you read. It's alarming that where is this going to end? The kids have come at us this summer out of brokenness of homes in Denver. That it ain't going to quit. There are 300 more teens pregnant this year than last in Colorado. You know, where is this all going to end? How can our society... it's that poem over and over and over again, and my fear is that we're not going to have enough substantial homes in this country very much longer that's going to keep us in service.
Yes, yes. I want to respond to that just a little bit after you talk. Go ahead.
Well, I become concerned with the church that is willing to put out food for the poor and food shelves and open up their basements for people shelter-wise. But where are they when it comes to taxes and voting in this country that provided the kind of administration
exactly.
that cut back
right.
on the housing for poor people? And I see more and more of these young families that I work with, you know, mothers of kids that have to end up in these shelters. And it's because it's easy for us to give to the person that we see next door when we see their hurting. But our tax dollars, that's not got anything to do with Christianity.
That's right.
And I have a lot of anger and hatred about that.
Well, you just about took the words out of my mouth, Joyce, and you said it better than I could have. But I feel, too, that when most of our tax dollars goes for weaponry, which is about 50% now, we need to do some rethinking in our country and how we respond to that as citizens. That we are the country. That's what they tell us in this wonderful democracy, that we have the say-so and the know-how. And how are we going to be addressing our government, that all of the things that are people-oriented have all been cut back? You go to one after the other. And if we say that as a church, our agenda for mission is people, we're living in an illusion in this country. And I think that we need to do something about that with our voting, with our letters, with our incessant badgering of the government.
I have to put in a plug for Bread for the World.
Oh, you're right. Okay. You're right. That's a big, go ahead.
We use the power of our citizenship.
Yes,
I address
right.
the legislator. You all know about Bread for the World, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
That is
wonderful. Much more all encompassing and effective than just giving a loaf of bread. Or,
yes.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yes, I. How many people are members of Bread for the World?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a wonderful informative agency too, and it's a Christian really a movement for it's a lobbying a Christian
yes,
lobbying
a Christian lobby.
Movement.
And it happens to be headed by Art Simon.
Art Simon. Mm-hmm.
Lutheran.
That's right. It's a great. Well, I need to say officially that this is closed, but I am willing to hang around for a little while and talk if you so desire. But for the tape, this session is officially closed.